Hey y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Scott Horton Show. Check out the new and improved website at scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003, plus whole show archives and my stress blog. And got a brand new section at scotthorton.org/documentaries, none of which I made, but all of which I thought were good and worth passing on to you, as many as I could think of anyway. Send me suggestions, scott@scotthorton.org, any documentaries that you want to see there in the new documentary section. And also, if you want, join up the chat room during the show. It's scotthorton.org/chat. Oh, and one more thing. Check out my new and improved Facebook page at facebook.com/scotthortonshow. It's now the kind you like instead of the kind you friend, which is different. All right. Eric Margulies is on the line. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How's it going?
Oh, it's good. We've got so much news, I don't even have time to do my Christmas shopping.
I know. It's really hard to get it done. My lucky break is I don't have much money for spending on presents for anybody, so my shopping is limited anyway. I can sit home and read and go crazy.
Very wise.
Yes. That was my plan all along, actually. Give myself more opportunity to go crazy. No, I appreciate having you on the show. As always, foreign correspondent Eric Margulies, been all around the world quite a few times and covered more wars than all the other reporters combined. And he wrote some books, too, War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. And he's now writing at UNZ.com, UNZ.com, as well as LouRockwell.com and his own website, EricMargulies.com, spelt like Margolis. EricMargulies.com. And here at the UNS Review, remember we were talking with Phil Giraldi about UNS.com, the UNS Review, UNZ.com. And here, Eric's latest piece is Kim Shows His Fangs. And I was very happy to see this because it's very rare. There are very few writers who really know their stuff about North Korea, and even fewer who are buddies of mine, who I can get on the show at a moment's notice to teach me all these things I need to know about North Korea and to teach everybody else, too, because, you know, I was having a conversation with somebody who said, "Yeah, what's our problem with North Korea? Don't they make all our cars and electronics and stuff?" And I thought, you know, people, they need their straightening out who makes what and who the North Koreans are. Let's start at year zero here. Who and what is North Korea? Who's running it now? And what's he showing his fangs about?
I've been watching North Korea since 1975. I find it a fascinating place, as I do South Korea, too, home of one of the great economic miracles of our time. North Korea, Korean culture is more than 1,000 years old. Korea was always considered, the United Korean Peninsula, as sort of a younger brother of China. It always had close relations with China, kind of followed the Chinese line on things. But at the end of World War II, Communist Party in North Korea, which was backed by Stalin, took power. It then began skirmishing with the South Korean, who were backed by the United States. They had a very nasty despot named Kim Il-sung, who was running North Korea very close to Stalin. And we had our own despot named Syngman Rhee, a fanatical South Korean Christian. Both sides were miserable. Both sides taunted the other. And eventually they went to war with North Korea invading South Korea, almost pushing it off the map. U.S. intervened, hence the 1950 Korean War. And after all the fighting we did, after years of fighting and tens of thousands of Americans dead, ended up at exactly the place they started on the 38th parallel. So that's the story. And the two Koreas have been at daggers drawn ever since with an enormously prosperous South Korea and with a decrepit and failing North Korea.
And even an official state of war between the two that's held this whole time, right? Nothing but a ceasefire rather than any kind of real peace agreement at the end of that war.
That's right. That's right.
And then, of course, that makes the great talking point for the North Koreans that, oh, yeah, well, we're going to suspend the ceasefire here any minute now if you don't look out, which they seem to bellow once or twice a year anyway, right?
I love North Korean political pronouncements on TV. They're a scream to watch. It makes me nostalgic for the Cold War. They have wonderful vocabularies, come up with the most hair-raising accusations. But the North Koreans have something to back it up, and that is they have a 1.1 million man army, which, though equipped with obsolescent equipment, very tough and very competent. And most important, the North Koreans have 11,000 pieces of heavy artillery and rocket batteries targeted in on Seoul, the South Korean capital, where almost half of all South Koreans live. It's only about 30-40 kilometers away from the north, and whose guns are dug into caves in the DMZ. So the north has a credible threat to make, and it routinely says it's going to burn Seoul to the ground if the Americans do anything. Plus, the North Koreans now have an estimated 3 to 6 crude nuclear weapons, and God knows what they would do with them. There are also 28,000 American troops sitting in South Korea, so the North can do a lot of damage.
Yeah, and sounds like all pretty quickly, too, with all that artillery there. But then again, I mean, the ceasefire is held all this time, and no side really has an interest in escalating beyond a bunch of chest beating, right?
That's correct. The North Korean regime is really interested in keeping itself in power. I've spent a lot of time in South Korea, and the people who are most worried about the bellicosity of the North Koreans are the Americans. South Koreans sort of shrug it off, even all these nuclear alarms, and there they go again. It's like having a demented uncle tucked away in the attic or something like that. I can tell you that what really scares the North Koreans is not an attack by North Korea, but what they call unexpected reunification. And that means that the North collapses, mm-hmm. and suddenly 25 million starving North Koreans start pouring south across the border, and that means that South Korea will have to take over the feeding and the rebuilding of North Korea, something that they really don't want to do.
Yeah, well, you know, I've heard it said, too, that, and maybe by you, that, you know, the Americans really don't want that reunification, either planned or unplanned, because then you combine the South's economy with the North's nukes. Although I'm not sure if they figured out how to implode a plutonium bomb yet. That's kind of difficult to make it go off right, I guess. But you combine those, and you really have a new separate power on par with Russia and China, if not exactly economic-wise. With an extra little boost for their possession of nuclear weapons there, and then that's just a whole new obstacle to deal with if you're trying to maintain the Pacific Ocean as an American lake, right?
That's right. It adds complexity. The Chinese are very worried that if North Korea collapses, that the U.S. will move military bases into North Korea, which are right next door to Manchuria, which is one of their key industrial and military areas.
Which they probably would, right?
Yes, they probably would, for security reasons, of course.
Yeah.
And it's kind of irresistible. The Japanese don't want to see United Korea because the Koreans hate the Japanese. And that's the last thing that they want to see. Japan has been quietly supporting North Korea. One of the main sources of hard cash for the North Korean government were pachinko parlors in Japan. There's like these upright pinball machines that Japanese love like crazy, and they all these places were run by ethnic North Koreans. In Japan, they kept financing the North Korean government. So it's a complicated situation. The Russians don't want to see any more American presence there either. The Chinese are nervous about the whole situation, because they could live certainly with the United Korea, but not if it falls under America's thumb.
Right. All right. So now talk all about the grandson here, Un, and his executed uncle.
Well, Un, who's somewhere between 27 and 30 years old, went to school in Switzerland. Young guy. He came to power at the death of his father, Kim Jong-il, who was the son of Kim Il-sung. So this is a dynasty. This is a Stalinist Korean hereditary dynasty. And young Kim was, there were a lot of questions whether he would be able to run things, whether he was going to grab all the reins of power, whether he was going to be told what to do by his powerful uncle and aunt, or by the powerful generals in the army. So and he was greeted with much derision and jocularity. And he surprised people, because first thing he did was to get to can a lot of the top generals of the huge North Korean army. And then he just had his uncle, that is uncle-in-law, hauled out of a court or a council meeting by the police, taken out a shot. And in Confucian culture, this is just a big no-no. You don't have your uncle-in-law shot like that. And but he did, and shocked everybody. And to me, it's certainly a sign of some grave crisis going on. Because normally, even if his uncle had been a big problem, if had him thrown in jail or poisoned him quietly and said that he died of a heart attack, but to take him out and shoot him shows weakness in the regime, shows something really bad going on, and shows very un-Confucian filial impiety.
Well, I mean, there, as best I understand, there's the biggest faction split inside the state is between the Communist Party and the military. Do you know which side the uncle was aligned with, and does this signal a shift toward the other, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, this is like old Kremlin watching used to be.
Or D.C. watching.
Or D. I wonder, you know, what color hat they're wearing. And his uncle was supposedly close to the generals of the North Korean army, the DPRK's army. I haven't heard much from the Communist Party, but no doubt that the army and the Communist Party share all the spoils. Food, perks, travel, cash, things like that. And there's always a certain built-in conflict between the two of them of who gets more. The rest of the North Koreans are left in the lurch to be very hungry. What was interesting that came out of this was that one of the statements, the uncle was accused of womanizing and drug dealing and being a gutter snipe and all kinds of things, but it said that, and he was doing this while the North Korean economy was in a catastrophic phase. So the government in North Korea finally admitted what everybody else knows, that they are in a catastrophic state.
Yeah, well, and about that, too, I know it's a real communist country. I mean, maybe the only real communist one around, maybe ever. So that just means everybody goes hungry all the time, and occasionally we hear stories, although usually in more tabloid papers like the Daily Mail or something, but occasionally from other places talking about, and I guess this happened under Mao in China too, and I guess in Ukraine under Stalin, people resorting to cannibalism in order to try to survive. Do you give much credence to reports like that? Is it really that bad in North Korea right now?
I treat them with great caution, because the South Korean intelligence service is always busy cooking up wild stories about North Korea, and some of them are true, most of them are not. South Korea's Christians who are very militant and very, very anti-communist are also spreading stories like that. So you have to take them with a grain of rice, but certainly ugly things are going on there in the north.
Yeah, I guess, you know, that's regardless of whether they're really eating each other's kids or whatever, it's still, you know, the epitome of desperation there. And they are that hungry, right, eating bark off the trees and whatever.
Well, you don't have a lot of tourists going to North Korea. Yeah, that's got to tell you something.
Hey, by the way, I'm of the opinion, and maybe we've talked about this before, but if we did, it was a while back. What do you make of Dennis Rodman and the Harlem Globetrotters and all that kind of thing? I think I heard he went back there, or he's going back there. He's going to train their entire basketball team, this kind of thing.
I think it's good. You know, I remember the opening to China began with ping pong diplomacy when nobody would talk to anyone else. And the more contacts we have with North Korea, it's good. This is good unofficial diplomacy. I'd pat him on the back if I could reach that high. And I saw a wonderful photo of Kim Jong-un with Dennis Rodman sitting a little ways to his left and Un turning to one of his aides saying, "You mean that's not President Obama?" So, yeah, good. Let him see what I can do. He may have a civilizing mission there.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it was George Stephanopoulos said to Dennis Rodman that, well, you know, they've got 200,000 people in prison camps. And Dennis Rodman says, yeah, Obama's got 2 million people in prison camps. So what?
That's true. That's a very good answer.
And so really, yeah, I mean, this guy is a blood-soaked monster, but so that makes him the same as any other politician that a celebrity like Dennis Rodman would be expected to stand next to and smile. So I can only see the good in it, you know?
I'm with you.
No different than him hanging out with a Republican.
No, I'm with you. We need a different policy towards North Korea. A lot of what North Korea is doing is, you see, we've waged economic war against North Korea since the Korean War. That's over 60 years ago, and we're still trying to overthrow the government there.
You're talking about regime change and how the policy still is, you know, I guess, never negotiate away outstanding issues between our two countries, from our government's point of view, that is. Never negotiate these issues away, keep them, so that someday there'll be an excuse for a regime change, hook or crook, right? Hell or high water, whether that means war or some kind of fancy CIA coup if they think they can get away with that, or just hang on until the whole place goes completely bankrupt, or what exactly does that mean anyway?
Well, we've used the same policy towards Iran and North Korea, and that is the American argument is, well, these are despicable, horrible people. We wouldn't even shake their hands, and we refuse to confer legitimacy on them by negotiating. The other side of the argument is, you know, it's stupid if you don't negotiate with people. That's what diplomacy is about. If you're ever going to achieve anything, you have to start entering into dialogue with them. Mind you, we have no problem kissing the hands of the Egyptian government, which has turned out to be one of the most brutal fascist governments in memory, or Uzbekistan, or China for that matter. But we won't deal with the North Koreans, and that's tied up with the Asian political situation we were just talking about, but also the fact that North Korea has gotten involved in the Middle East, and the neocons in Washington have been working for a decade to sabotage any agreement or any opening to North Korea, because North Korea is regarded as a potential weapons supplier to the Arab states and Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the whole proliferation security initiative that John Bolton came up with that helped push him out of the NPT, was the declaration
right
that we're going to seize all their boats on the high seas and all that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, back in 02. Well, and so, I mean, it seems to me like any regime change there would mean reunification kind of by necessity, right? It'd be like the fall of the wall and reunification in Germany. There'd be no way around it if the communist regime fell, right?
It would be, but I'm telling you, South Korea's economy is not that strong to be able to rebuild North Korea and feed 25 million people. The Koreans would do it. I mean, the Koreans can do practically anything. You know, close to 1960, the gross income per capita in South Korea was about the same as Central Africa at that time. Mm-hmm. And North Korea was actually, at the end of the Korean War, actually had a bigger economy than South Korea. But these amazing Koreans, by sheer work, willpower, built themselves up to the world's 11th economy and are continuing to do it. So, yeah, they can do it, but look how long it took Germany to absorb East Germany. Koreans are afraid that this would bankrupt their economy.
Right. All right, now, so I want to ask you about that fascist dictatorship in Egypt that you mentioned there. I want to hear a lot of what you have to say about that. But for the last couple minutes before the bottom of the hour break, I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about Mandela. My thing is I took that week off when he died and everybody was talking on and on about Mandela. And so I didn't do, you know, focus on him on the radio and all that. It all blown over. Everybody was just talking about the sign language guy by the time I was back. But what a scandal that was. I don't know. I figure I have no idea really what you have to say about him. But I figure you obviously must have a lot to say about him and probably something wise. So why don't you tell us your kind of thumbnail, should take away from his death and mourning here.
I was covering southern Africa, Angola, Mozambique, Namibia, et cetera, during that period in the late 80s. So I was there just as he was getting out of prison. I almost got an interview with him. I have enormous respect for Mandela because he probably prevented a race war in South Africa by tempering the anger and bloodlust of his people. Yes, he was a communist. He headed up the militant wing of the African National Congress that was attacking whites and planting bombs in cafes and murdering little white farmers isolated. I was with the South African anti-guerrilla squads. I saw it myself. They were committing acts that were terrorism. And in fact, I believe Mandela was on the U.S. terrorist list until sometime in the 1978 or something like that. He denounced Israel as a imperialist, as a racist state, practicing colonialism. For this, he has never been forgiven by supporters of Israel or parts of the American media. But all in all, Mandela he set a great role model. Nobody will follow it, but in South Africa, he was called the Black Jesus. And in some ways, he really was.
Yeah, it seems like all the fighting about is whether whether he was really a communist or not, or whether he was just palling around with him. And everybody wants to take sides right and left over whether he was good or bad. But it seemed like, you know, I don't understand why it's so hard for people to say, well, you know, on one hand this and on the other hand that. But everybody wants to just be, you know, pro or anti. So.
Well, this is because we in America much too often impose our domestic political stances on foreign affairs situation. And it's a terrible mistake.
Yeah.
Mandela was not a Black Jesus, in my view, but he was pretty much like a South African Gandhi.
Which, hey, that's not so bad, you know, as long as people are categorizing. Yeah, he was known as the Gandhi of this region. Okay, all right, we'll take that. All right, we got Eric Margolese on the line. He wrote War at the Top of the World, an American Raj, Liberation or Domination, foreign correspondent for many, many years, now writing for LouRockwell.com and UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. His piece is Kim Shows His Fangs. But now it's time to ask about Egypt. You just referred to the government there as a brutal fascist dictatorship. But whatever happened to John Kerry said that they're just restoring the democracy over there.
Well, his nose should grow much, much longer. You know, I'd hope that Kerry would be a more forceful and a more honest Secretary of State, but He hasn't gotten off to a brilliant start. He's done some good things, but not that. And the case of Egypt is really shameful. Here we promoted, we helped promote the overthrow of the democratically elected government of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt. We cooperated in a campaign to destabilize and overthrow him. And we then refused to call it a military coup, even though tanks had killed, you know, crushed the demonstration. Over 11 to 1,400 demonstrators were gunned down in the street. If this happened in Iran, we'd be yelling bloody murder, but happened in Egypt, well, it's too bad. And what's happened is that out of the turmoil there has come a military junta. But it's the nature of this junta that's very unusual. It's not your run-of-the-mill Arab generals. This seems to be General al-Sisi, was supposedly an ally of President Morsi, who's now in jail, by the way, has turned out to be the closest I've seen in a long time since my days in the 1980s in Lebanon to this weird growth of Arab fascism. It's very ugly. There are mass arrests going on in Egypt. Mubarak's repressive engines have all been restarted again. The police are everywhere, mass arrests, torture, you name it, and all to glorify the Egyptian army.
All right, now, hold on 1 second. Two things. First of all, your phone sounds a little screwy, so I wonder if maybe you're stretching the cord there at a weird angle, something like that.
Maybe. Sorry.
And then secondly, how would you differentiate the fascism in this military dictatorship from the way it was under Mubarak?
Okay, Professor Paxton at Columbia University has written an excellent book on the subject called Totalitarianism. And really the way you differentiate fascism from extreme right-wing governments, like Franco in Spain was not a fascist, he was extreme right-winger. But the fascists have a certain key elements, which are the exaltation of the military, the need to keep looking for foreign enemies, the glorification of the Egyptian or the Euro people as being extraordinary. The leader is above all question. He incarnates the will of the people. And you are constantly assailed by foes from the outside and subversives from within.
This sounds a little bit like a certain superpower I know.
Oh, well, you may be right.
But in what way is Sisi's government really different than Mubarak's?
Mubarak's was extremely repressive. In fact, when I was in Egypt, I was amazed. I had people, security agents, following me around with notebooks and things, taking notes of everywhere I went, everything I saw. It was an extremely repressive government, one of the world's most repressive and brutal, but the Western media shut its eyes to that and never reported on that. So we've gone back to that in Egypt, but whereas the Mubarak regime tried to keep it undercover, the Sisi regime is just pulling people off the streets and throwing them in jail and throwing children in jail and threatening to mow down more people if they get in the way. So it's much more brutal.
Yeah, you know, I talk with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, who lives in Cairo from time to time, and he was talking about how it's sort of this really kind of bad choice that the liberals, if you can call them that, I guess, more the April 6th movement and the labor union socialists and that kind of thing, maybe the richer citizens of Cairo or a certain part of town or something, that they really had made a bad choice in siding with the military against the Muslim Brotherhood. Because even though the Muslim Brotherhood was, you know, against what they wanted in terms of policy in a lot of ways, they still were abiding by the rules of win some, lose some in the electoral process. And it seemed like the liberals should have been making themselves allies of the process more than anything else. Now they've sided with the military, which has just canceled any citizen influence at all, and started arresting them too.
Well, it's most unfortunate. A lot of these so-called liberals or city dwellers, urban elite, are having a nasty surprise. They'll learn to live with the military as they did with Mubarak, I suggest. But what happened was that the reason that the coup occurred, what laid the groundwork for it, was that the secret police and the military and certain outside powers caused massive social disruption in Egypt. There were interruptions of food supplies, electricity failures, gas failures. The police were pulled off the streets. You know, that's a very scary thing. I was in Cairo, and suddenly there were no police, and people were being attacked, and women were being raped. It was never heard of in the past. So they completely destabilized the society there, taking a leaf from the old Iran playbook during the days of Mossadegh. And it got everybody so angry at the government, which was helpless, couldn't do anything, that that opened the way for the coup.
And you know what? I heard it here first. I mean, Phil Giraldi, a year ago, almost a year ago, I think it would have been January of this year, 2013, which 6 months before the coup, was saying, yeah, I'm hearing from CIA friends that the Saudis are bankrolling rent-a-mobs and turning protests into violent riots.
Sure they did. And Egypt's finances were attacked abroad from Wall Street, and the Bahrainis and the, you know, the Gulf states were also supporting these rent-a-mobs and the people moving against Egypt. And in fact, we can see, because they've now forked out up to $18 billion to Egypt to finance the current regime.
All right. Now, is it okay if I keep you longer and ask you more things?
You're holding me prisoner. I can't escape. This is okay. Radio Guantanamo.
Yeah, exactly. We'll shackle you to the wall and make you answer the question.
Okay.
Tell me all about South Sudan. Nobody else can, Eric, not like you.
Oh, interesting story. Interesting. Sudan used to be Africa's largest country. It was created by the British. And being British, they did what they did all over the world, is they welded together all sorts of disparate peoples, tribes, languages, and religions just for their colonial convenience. So in Sudan, you had in the northern part of Sudan was a so-called Arab culture, speaking Arabic, predominantly Muslim. And then in the south of Sudan, the far south, which is really Central African, it's very jungled and remote, you have two very strong ethnic tribes, the Nuers and the Luers, and the Dinka, who are predominantly animist and then Christian, no Muslims, and they were ruling in the south. And they've been fighting the north for, 20 years. And they've been fighting each other for 20 years because these tribes on the Upper Nile fought each other for cattle and women. Stone Age kind of behavior. But the U.S. learned that there was oil in South Sudan. And since the Sudanese government has refused to play ball with Washington, they were on our doo-doo list anyway. So over the past few years, we, the United States, engineered the official breakup of Sudan, and South Sudan, which has all of Sudan's oil that was discovered just by coincidence, broke away from Sudan under American tutelage, with American advisors, with American money and help, and set up this independent South Sudan. So that's where we are today.
Well, and then now there's been a coup and a civil war inside South Sudan, and Obama's threatening, in his language, he left open further intervention, not just sending in the Marines to help citizens escape, which citizens meaning spies, I guess, whoever, State Department goons. But leaving, I forget his exact words, but he was leaving. It sounded like he was leaving the door open to further intervention being possible.
Oh, it's already underway.
Further action, he called it.
Powers, Obama has this Susan Powers and Susan Rice these two women who are both ardent Africa firsters. And they've got this onward Christian soldier thrill to be going helping the abused people in Africa. They're sort of like liberal neocons. And they've obviously influenced Obama. But what's happening is that the South Sudan government is being propped up by the Americans. And we found out just yesterday that the U.S. had flown helicopters, first the Osprey planes, these are two-engine sort of tilt-rotor planes, into the oil fields area of Sudan to extract American CIA and Special Forces units. What they were doing there, no one has said, but it's very interesting. So they were exfiltrated out of the combat area. UN people who were working for the United States, because the UN has become in many areas an arm of the U.S. State Department, were also pulled out. But now we learn that troops from another American protectorate, which is Uganda, are moving into the capital and heading for Juba, which is the capital in the south, and possibly Ethiopian troops may also be on the way. These are troops from this American Entente in southern Africa that have been very close to American policy and have gotten a lot of American dollars.
All right, with that, I'll let you go. Thanks for staying overtime, especially, Eric, and doing the show.
My
today.
Pleasure.
Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas to you. Cheers.
All right, everybody, that is the great Eric Margulies. I kept him way over time. Soon I'll have to have him back to ask him about Musharraf. And is he really going on trial over there for treason? Certainly he's guilty of treason. But anyway, so that'll be coming up soon. The great Eric Margulies, ericmargulies.com, and now he's also writing for uns.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy. And all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah. no water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.